This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In times of profound uncertainty, society may be subject to a veritable plague of toxic feelings and fantasies, which fuel various forms of political reaction.
Professor Paul Hoggett, reactionary states of mind as the Holocene ends.
Never has our future been more unpredictable. Never have we depended so much on political forces that look like sheer insanity. It is as though mankind had divided itself between those who believe in human omnipotence and those for whom powerlessness has become the major experience of their lives.
Yes, indeed, we all see it. In the UK, social policy researcher Paul Hoggett finds a key to retrogression and denial as climate and civilization itself spin out of control. Hoggett is Professor Emeritus at the University of West of England in Bristol. His latest paper is Reactionary States of Mind as the Holocene Ends. Paul is the co-founder and first chair of the Climate Psychology Alliance. From Bristol, Paul Hoggett, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Good to speak to you, Alex.
Paul, listeners just heard the quote that opens your new paper, and it's from Hannah Arendt's seminal book, The Origins of Totalitarianism. That was published in 1951. It rings so true almost 75 years later. Doesn't that tell us that times of crisis come and go?
Well, they certainly do. And when she was speaking, obviously, it was primarily an economic crisis, which had heralded the rise of fascism in the 1920s and 1930s. But I think this time we've got an accumulation of different crises. But for me, the most important and underlying one is the ecological one.
And you write, and I'm going to quote you here, in times of profound uncertainty, society may be subject to a veritable plague of toxic feelings and fantasies which fuel various forms of political reaction. That certainly sounds like politics now in North America, in the UK to some degree, and even in some surprising places in Europe. What has happened to us?
Well, we as a Western civilization, I don't think, are very good at dealing with uncertainty, either at an individual and certainly not at a collective level. When we're in a situation where old solutions no longer seem to work, there is a sense in which I think panic begins to spread out across the surface of, like, you know, petrol on water. When you see petrol spreading out across the surface of water, it's a bit like that with panic. It is one of the most contagious feelings around, something that's been thought about and reflected on for a long time by group psychologists.
And the key here is a concept conceived almost 100 years ago by German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche. It's ressentiment in French. And this French word sounds like resentment, but it's different.
Yeah. The key is that in French and German, the stress is very much not just upon the resentment, but the way in which the feeling is nursed. In other words, normally one would think of resentment as a kind of a toxic emotion that one would try to get rid of. But continental writers stress the way in which ressentiment, as they called it, was a feeling which we nursed. And the phrase that a number of writers have used was, it's as if we keep the wound open. We pick at the scab. We keep the soreness and tenderness, in a way, aflame. That's called nursing the grievance by a number of people within the psychoanalytic world, nursing the grievance. And I think it's something quite familiar to us as individuals. But I think when it is a collective phenomena, it becomes a very powerful and dangerous phenomena. Because essentially it's what we would call an affect rather than an emotion. You know, an emotion has always got an object. An emotion like fear has an object. We are frightened of something or other. Whereas an affect like ressentiment or anxiety doesn't have an object, so it's free-floating. You could say it's looking for an object to attach itself to. And that's precisely what populist leaders do.
We have an example on stage here with Donald Trump, but really, we can't just say, oh, well, that's one person. There are millions of people who are following that mental trail who feel that they are victimized, and not just in America.
Oh, no, no, that's right. I suppose one of the key differences we have now compared to the 1920s and 30s is social media. You know, that's something which I think greatly amplifies these kinds of group psychological processes, which they didn't have in the 20s and 30s. It is remarkable how, nevertheless, the Nazis in particular were very calculating and clever and thoughtful about the way in which they used communication and propaganda. They were incredibly sophisticated, people like Goebbels and so on. They knew exactly how to, in a sense, anchor these otherwise toxic kind of affects, resentment and anxiety, and give them a focus. And in their case, obviously, one of the key focuses was the Jews, you know, and the argument that the Jews in particular had in some sort of way stabbed Germany in the back during the First World War. You know, that was why they weren't successful. Or the communists or whoever it might be, they would look for an object to anchor these kind of resentful feelings.
Well, now it's the deep state, but nobody can really say just exactly who that is. So your first approach to this subject comes through the lens of psychoanalysis, but Nietzsche, followed by the German philosopher Max Schleier in the early 1900s, they developed a psychology of mind before Sigmund Freud pioneered psychoanalysis. Yeah. Is ressentiment really a thing in psychoanalytic practice?
The nearest equivalent is in the work of there's a British psychoanalyst called John Steiner, who I wrote about in that article, I think, that you saw, where he talks quite extensively about the way in which we nurse the grievance. And he links it to what he calls a psychic retreat, a place we go into in our mind, a kind of, you would almost say it's an internal fortress, where we look out from this fortress with suspicion, constantly on the alert, our radar constantly looking for the possibility of insults and slights and wounds of one form or another. So he would be the nearest one would get in terms of mainstream psychoanalytic thinking. But the figure is very familiar. I'm also a practicing psychotherapist, and that kind of person who you might meet as a therapist, but also you recognize, I think all of us recognize something of this in ourselves. We all have the capacity to do this. You know, it's important not to just locate it in the other.
What, me? Nurse a grudge?
absolutely. I mean, when I talk about climate communication, particularly when we're engaged in communication on a one-to-one basis with friends, families, colleagues, or neighbors, it's so easy to go into these kinds of conversations harboring a kind of resentment towards the other who we imagine is going to be our opponent. And in no time at all, rather than the conversation, we've got into an argument.
When we look at attendees of Trump rallies, they're almost all white, many working class. You did a number of studies on white working class grievance in the United Kingdom. How did they go from we are the champions to we are the victims?
There's a very interesting relationship, isn't there, between victim and perpetrator. We like to keep those two things very separate, as if they are separate categories. But of course they're not, and the victim and the perpetrator is in everybody and in every group, including, for example, at the moment, and I know this might be quite controversial, but I think in a tragic kind of way, Jews who've become victims of the Holocaust in many ways now find themselves in terms of the conflict going on in Gaza as the perpetrators, which is terribly sad and tragic. But I think it's important that we understand that we're all capable of being both victims and perpetrators, that there's a very subtle kind of constant fluid relationship between these two things. Nobody is able to allocate to themselves virtue.
In the state of ressentiment, how does claiming to be a victim prove that that person is right, no matter what others say.
Well, that's one of the great consolations of victimhood, of being, of feeling oneself the victim, is victims feel themselves to be in the right. They feel themselves to be the object of persecution, and typically they are as well. This is not imaginary. But it's very difficult when we get into that way of thinking about our lives, either as individual or groups, to begin to understand that the good doesn't always just reside in us and the bad in the other. You know, that very simplistic way of splitting the world between good and bad is a very powerful and very destructive kind of dynamic. And we have to kind of, I think it's really important that we are able to own up to our own destructive capacities.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from Bristol, UK. We're talking with Professor Emeritus Paul Hoggett, author of the new book, Paradise Lost, The Climate Crisis and the Human Condition. In the early days, followers of Adolf Hitler and Vladimir Lenin were convinced they were the good people doing the right thing. Paul, what can we learn from the differences and similarities in these supposed opposites of National Socialism, the Nazis, and Soviet Communism?
Well, both the Nazis and the Communists in the 20s and 30s believed themselves to be in the possession of an ideal which is in some sort of way a perfected view of the world and of reality, something that they themselves were in exclusive possession of. And I think this is the hallmark of fundamentalism, whether it's Islamic fundamentalism, whether it's Christian fundamentalism, whether it's fascism. There is a sense in which one has, in some sort of way, exclusive possession of this ideal, of this way of thinking about the world and being in the world, which has this tremendous power to it, you know, the power to unlock all secrets, the power to get to the truth, that no matter what cost. And Hannah Arendt was very insightful about the power of that kind of ideal. She talked about followers of those kind of fundamentalist ideologies as adepts, you know, almost like the religious adept, you know, the person who has the sophisticated, detailed understanding of the religious texts, which nobody else has, and can see in those texts things that others can't see. And of course, we're in the vicinity of modern conspiracy theory and the way in which it operates, and organized, and networks like QAnon, you know, where, in a sense, they're accumulating online adepts, aren't they? People who have these kind of texts, which in the mind of these followers open all sorts of secrets that nobody else can see, but they have exclusive possession of. It's a very sophisticated and complex phenomenon, I think, this whole process of fundamentalist thought.
In your new book, Paradise Lost, you find the climate emergency could drive authoritarian nationalism. How would that work?
There's a concept that's quite well established now within thinking about climate politics, which actually comes from an American journalist called Christian Parenti, and it's called the politics of the armed lifeboat. If you like, it's like the metaphor is of the Titanic or some other huge liner sinking. So this is civilization, Western civilization. It struck an iceberg, and there is a great danger of the whole vessel sinking. And it's already listing dangerously, and many, many people have started falling into the water. And they're floundering about and thrashing about, and there are already some lifeboats there in the water. And as they flounder and thrash about in the water, they struggle to board, to get on board these lifeboats. But the people on the lifeboats already realize that if too many people get on, they will sink and everyone will drown. And so they try desperately to push them off. with oars, with guns, with whatever it might be, to keep them at bay. So it's a metaphor of the armed lifeboat. And so if you think about it in terms of the what's now happening with the climate crisis, one of the phenomena that we're already beginning to see is what I call ecological austerity, that there are whole parts of the world already in which life is becoming increasingly uninhabitable. Central America is a classic example where crop failures repeatedly are driving people out of Central American countries towards Mexico and the border with the United States. And in Europe, we're seeing it repeatedly as climate change severely affects agricultural production in parts of the African Sahel and the Middle East. And so ecological austerity, I think, is very much happening already and is beginning to find its effect in food prices and so on. And the politics of the armed lifeboats basically says that as the ship starts to go down, as the climate crisis deepens, nations will be pushed towards keeping the others out and securing their own food and energy resources. So this is the politics of the armed lifeboat. You secure your own agricultural, your own food and energy resources. They're absolutely vital. And you begin to close your borders to keep out the refugees from Central America, from North Africa, from the Middle East, and so on and so forth. And I think, particularly in Europe, I can't speak about what it's like in North America, but particularly in Europe, you can begin to see this taking place very rapidly now as there's a shift towards authoritarian nationalism in a whole number of European countries. Hungary was the first. Italy has followed. France might soon go down the same path. So that's the metaphor, the politics of the armed lifeboat. And if we don't watch out, and if we don't begin to tackle this climate crisis, and there's not much sign of us doing it at the present moment, that's the kind of politics I fear that we're heading towards. And the great danger, of course, is then we begin to lose our collective humanity.
Well, part of the modern mystique is a belief that science, technology, and effort can solve every problem. In your 2023 paper about reactionary states of mind, you suggest there may be no solution for the climate crisis. So what does that mean, and what then?
Well, I don't know that I said no solution. I don't think there is no technical solution. There is a huge desire for us to come up with some technical fixes, you know, like the giant aerosols at the high-altitude atmosphere, or carbon capture and storage or whatever it might be, some technical fixes to a problem which is fundamentally one about the way in which we organize ourselves, our economies, our politics, and our cultures. And until we begin to change that way in which we organize those things, no amount of technical fixes is going to really, you know, solve things as far as I'm concerned. So we need to go beyond technical fixes, which very often just draw upon that very Western form of rationality. You know, give me a problem and I will solve it in a technical, mechanistic kind of way. Whereas I'm sure you found from your own work and many of the people that you've interviewed that unless we begin to think in a systems way, in a systematic way, we will never actually find the solutions that we require. So it's not that I don't think there are any solutions, but the solutions have to be systemic ones, have to be systematic ones.
So, Paul, many of us encounter people, friends, workmates, or family, who very strongly believe they are victims in search of justice. And all facts to the contrary are labeled as government or media or academic lies. How can characters nursing deep wounds, whether real or imaginary, be reached? Or can they?
That's a difficult question. I mean, there's a danger. Let's put it like this. There's a danger that climate change politics becomes a politics of the compassionate and concerned middle classes. And there is therefore a danger of it setting itself up in precisely the way in which populists such as Trump and others want to portray it as another kind of woke preoccupation of the middle classes. And they will therefore appeal to their poor, white, working class base and say, look, you know, don't take this. This is rubbish. This is, don't take this seriously. This is another lie from another globalist lie. So I think it's absolutely crucial that a climate politics is also a politics of social justice and economic equality. Otherwise, we will just be so easily split off by populists such as Trump and others as middle-class do-gooders.
Another long-time worry I've had is that there could be green fascism. You know, the situation becomes so severe with storms and crop failures and so on that a great leader emerges to be a dictator of what energy you can use. I mean, when we look back, Hitler was a vegetarian. We had Heidegger talking about the rights of rivers. There was a plan to restock with the original species the cleared out eastern parts of Europe, a horrible vision of green restoration. So it could happen again. And I'm wondering, is there a way when we're under super stress and there are millions of people on the move due to climate change that we can avoid that fate of the green dictator?
I mean, it's a very important issue. There's a new film that's just come out, which I very much recommend to your listeners, called The Zone of Interest. I don't know whether it's come over to the States at the moment. But it's a film based on the life of Rudolf Hess, who is the butcher of Auschwitz. And he was the commandant at Auschwitz. And he was a back-to-the-land lover of nature, and so is his wife. And it's portrayed very graphically in this film. You know, the idea that in some sort of way to be in touch with nature and to see nature as crucial is purely a liberal or progressive kind of value is something profoundly mistaken. It can be very easily incorporated into very nationalistic, if not even fascistic, kinds of outlooks.
So that's a Zone of Interest?
Zone of Interest, yes. It's just come out in the UK 2 weeks ago.
I'll hunt it down and see if I can find a link for our listeners. Now, isn't there a bit of an element of what Alvin Toffler called future shock in all this? The public sees warnings all around. And developments like AI and climate change and cyber warfare, they can't really understand it, but they do fear it. So instinctively, they want to go back in time to systems where at least they understood the dangers. Is that a problem psychologically? Is that leading to ressentiment?
We've got something there, maybe slightly different, Alex. You know, I'm not sure I've thought about it particularly deeply, but it strikes me that there is something also there about nostalgia, looking back to times past in an idealized kind of way. Maybe there is a resentment about the future in that sense, a ressentiment about the future, a bitterness about the future. And certainly you do find that with certain forms of conservatism, particularly maybe with older people. It's the future itself which is a source of complaint and hurt, almost. So I think maybe there's something slightly different there between nostalgia and ressentiment. But the way in which in many reactionary ideologies something of the past is fetishized, you know, make America great again, as if there was some golden age which has been lost. I mean, it was very powerful current in Nazi Germany as well. But I think the interesting thing about fascism and communism, that although certainly fascism had a very strong nostalgic element to it, it was also a profoundly forward-looking, future-oriented movement. You know, and I think I mentioned it in this piece that I sent you. Hitler was very irritated and annoyed with people like Mussolini, who were, he felt, just backward-looking nationalists. Fascism for Hitler was far more than that. It was embracing the future, as far as many fascists were concerned. And certainly many communists, you know, they saw the communism as, both of them, fascism and communism, as utopias. They were utopian movements, both of them. And I don't think we've reached that anywhere yet. There's a very important difference, I think, between authoritarian nationalism, often very backward-looking on the one hand, and these kind of fundamentalist utopian movements on the other. It's easier for us to see fascism everywhere, whereas actually I think it's a fairly unique and discrete kind of phenomena.
Wrapping up here, you say the descent toward the reactionary state of mind is not irreversible. What can we do? What can we do?
I think there are sorts of things we can do at all sorts of different levels. You know, at the most basic, simple, human, everyday level, there is something about really being clear and fighting for what we mean by humanity and human values. You know, because that is fundamental. If we're to avoid any kind of descent into inhumanity, we must know, you know, how that occurs so easily, so quickly. How any of us, in that sense, can slip into that kind of inhuman way of thinking and being in the world. So I think that's the very first thing that we need to consider, is at a very individual level. And then, of course, collectively, we have to then begin to see how that translates into making a stand around certain fundamental issues. You know, so for many people in Europe at the present moment in time, one of those fundamental issues is the Ukraine and Russian attempt to destroy Ukrainian democracy. And for a growing number of people in Europe as well at the present moment, the whole issue of what's happening in Gaza, again, is raising this issue of we must make a stand against a collective collapse into inhumanity. So there are these kind of moments in history when it becomes really important for people to make a kind of collective stand. And then, obviously, we've got to tackle these kind of big world issues that we're facing. And in particular, as I feel, the key world issue that we're facing is this, you know, the climate crisis, which we huff and puff about and come up with all sorts of good intentions, a kind of performative politics, but very little actually seems to change.
Paul Hoggett is Professor Emeritus at the University of West England in Bristol. His latest paper is Reactionary States of Mind as the Holocene Ends. Look for Paul's new book, Paradise Lost, The Climate Crisis and the Human Condition. You can find links to follow up in my show blog published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Paul, thank you for helping us understand.
That's a pleasure, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.